This is the current federal tax developments for the week of October the 7th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by the Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to be looking at a few things happening in the areas of tax. We'll talk first about a ruling from the state of Pennsylvania that explicitly mentions the Wayfair case in Pennsylvania's now new ruling that will expand their economic nexus test to get a $500,000 rule for income taxes. Pennsylvania explains why the Wayfair case clears the way for not worrying about whether you're in Pennsylvania. We're going to determine about whether you have nexus there to file an income tax return. We're also going to talk about the Section 164 limit on state and local taxes, specifically a discussion that came up on Twitter regarding the impact of that limitation on Schedule A deductions if you have investment land or something similar on which there are taxes being paid. Does a $10,000 cap apply? We'll discuss that. The law seems to give an answer. We'll talk about we'll talk about some issues here relating to drafts of the Form 1065, the 1120S, and the K-1s, and some information the IRS is going to be asking for in the future on your partnership and S-Corp returns. And we'll close out with proposed regulations that give us some answers to how the individual coverage HRA that was released earlier in the year, the IRS said we could start using next year, how that would integrate for an applicable large employer with the shared responsibility payment issues. In essence, how we find out if we're offering affordable coverage that provides, you know, what we need to, how we make the test, what's the affordability test, how all of that works. The most important thing, figuring out what's the cost of the insurance for the required contribution for the employee. And that's part of our trading. That's part of what we're going to be working on here. So we have all of these things coming up, looking at this week and what's going on here in taxes. Now, remember, we do have coming up, once we get past the deadline, and you all probably know about that deadline coming up here on the 15th of October, I am going to be doing a session that will be broadcast on October the 16th. It will be an online CalCPA rebroadcast of the advanced partnership issues featuring the new partnership audit rules. Like most CalCPA rebroadcast, it's going to be a dual start. So it starts at, there's one set at 6 a.m. Pacific time, one at 8 a.m. Pacific time that starts. CalCPA's website offers both options. Your state society most likely will choose the one most appropriate for your area of the country. You know, you may not want to get up super early if you're on the West Coast for the 6 a.m. version, because that means probably going to be need to be logging in somewhere, you know, around 5:45 or so, and like, yeah, it's early in the morning. But the flip side of that is if you're on the West Coast, then you probably, or I should say if you're on the East Coast, you probably don't want to wait until 11 a.m. in the morning to start. That's not so bad, maybe 11 a.m. start, but when it ends at 6:30 in the evening, well, that goes a little long. So check to see the availability. We will be running that though on October the 16th, the new partnership audit rules and all the fun we've got going down that path. But with that, let's go ahead and start talking about what's actually happened this week. And let's begin with the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has issued in Pennsylvania Corporation Tax Bulletin 2019-04 that was issued on September the 30th. The state of Pennsylvania announced that they are going to begin applying an economic nexus rule for income taxes in the state beginning in 2020. And that economic nexus rule is going to trigger a required filing for income tax purposes by a business if it has more than $500,000 worth of sales into the state. So it'll be a sales-based requirement here for coming into the state. Why they're deciding to do it is because, Pennsylvania's justification, that the Wayfair case opens the door for this. The department, in their analysis, has a pretty good analysis about why they think Wayfair has opened the door. And they note that, in fact, you know, we had this, the Quill rule, as they said, the court said, for sales taxes, the physical presence test was unsound and incorrect. The reason, probably not unreasonably, that if it's unsound and incorrect for sales taxes, it's probably unsound and incorrect for income taxes. So they're going to say, well, if you're selling into the state, you're doing business in the state. More specifically, they say, as the court did in Wayfair, we want to use the complete auto transit case as our analysis, right? We continue to do that. So the big issue there is going to be with fair apportionment And with the issue of, as long as we don't violate the Commerce Clause by making it too difficult for various businesses to comply, it's going to be okay to require them to file in the state. They do specifically note there is this one special case we have for income taxes, Public Law 86272. For those who are not aware of that, Congress, back 60 plus years ago, in response to a previous Supreme Court decision that dealt with income taxes being applied by a state on a business located in another state, had set up a special exemption that was very specific to the actual fact pattern in the case the court heard. And it says that a state is not allowed to impose an income tax generally on a company that merely has salespeople in the state, where the sales are approved out of state, shipped from out of state, and you don't sell anything but those products. You can't sell services, anything else. You don't perform any other functions in the state. The state of Pennsylvania is stating that you should still be filing and claiming your 86272 exemption if you say all we're doing is that. We'll see if that holds up or not. It'll be kind of interesting to see how far that goes. 86272, to be totally honest, is a law that was meant to be temporary when it was passed 60 years ago. Unfortunately, for it to be non-temporary, Congress would have to have gone in and tried to figure out really a comprehensive set of rules of when states could impose an income tax. As you might guess, Congress was not too thrilled with that, because when you start doing that, it gets complicated, it gets messy, they get yelled at by state legislators for basically meddling in things they shouldn't meddle in, and so they haven't done it. The history of that law, though, does tell us a lot about the fact that if you think Congress is going to come in and solve the Wayfair problem, 86272 suggests that they really aren't likely. The one time they did it, they did a temporary patch, which they then decided we're just going to ignore and let stay put for 60 plus years. So I'll put it this way. If they finally come back and solve the income tax issue that they deferred back 60 years ago, maybe they'll solve Wayfair. I wouldn't hold out much hope for it. Now, the other interesting aside was Pennsylvania decided that the limitation should be higher than the sales tax $100,000 limit from the South Dakota case. It kind of decided that, at least in their impression, that the income tax is a more significant and maybe troublesome tax to comply with. I'm not so sure. I think a lot of us think that the complexities of trying to figure out what exactly is and is not taxable under a sales tax make most income taxes look pretty simple, because most income taxes follow the federal model. But nevertheless, they do have half million. I'm not going to complain. I'm not going to volunteer to come in below $500,000. But it is interesting they went there. We'll see if other states follow. But the unique part about this is it is an explicit citation of Wayfair by a state agency to apply existing law. And we may see other states follow in Pennsylvania's footsteps. So be careful. The income tax shoe is maybe about ready to drop following the Wayfair case. Next up, I got involved in a discussion on Twitter, of all places, involving the question of investment property taxes. And the question arose regarding, if you remember, part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Congress added Section 164B6. And it gave us a $10,000 cap on state and local tax deductions on Schedule A. At least that's the way everybody talked about it, that the most you could deduct for state and local taxes on Schedule A was 10 grand. But the interesting aside about that is it's not quite so simple if you actually go read the code. Yes, the actual section, and I realize some people get really upset. I've had CPAs before get after me saying, why do you always give code sections? I mean, that's complicated. It's messy. Don't talk about code sections. That's just confusing. You can't read that. Problem. When we got a brand new tax law, all we have, and in this area, this is all we have, is what's in the code. Secondly, when you go to secondary sources like the committee reports, I know a lot of you like to look at committee reports. The problem there is if the committee report does not agree with the black letter law, the courts are never going to follow the committee report. Committee reports are useful for resolving ambiguities. But if the law itself is not ambiguous, then the committee report does nothing. This particular piece, I don't believe, is at all ambiguous, and I'm not sure the committee reports really disagree with it. But then we go to even one more removed. Many people get their tax updates by listening to things like this broadcast, by maybe reading some articles, and in those cases, things do get summarized. And especially with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, with all the changes we had, it was very easy to summarize the change by saying state and local taxes, we're going to now limit on Schedule A for itemized deductions and deduction for state and local taxes to $10,000. That sort of statement is one I'm sure I've made. I'm sure everybody who's done these courses have done it, because there was so many things to cover and so much detail, you didn't spend an hour talking about the 164B6 limitation. You know, you talked about it was 10 grand. You talked more about, well, could the states challenge it? How about the workarounds and all those things? But you didn't really do a deep dive on the section itself. Maybe it's important to do that deep dive, because this is something that was actually pointed out to me early in the year, and I kind of thought it'd become common knowledge. But you do the deep dive, and it's like, no, apparently a lot of people hadn't done this dive yet. And the question becomes, what about land you hold for investment? So the $10,000 cap clearly applies to my home, right? But what if I go buy a piece of raw land? You know, I go get a piece of raw land along Interstate 10, you know, between Phoenix and Los Angeles. You know, it's kind of a nice long stretch, not a whole lot on it. Yeah, it'll be developed someday, right? That's the whole theory. So I have a nice piece of raw land out there. I'm waiting for development to get to it. So I'm just sitting on this raw land. I'm paying property taxes on this land every year. And maybe I've got quite a bit of it, so I'm paying $20,000 a year in property taxes on this raw land. Prior to Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that deduction would have gone on Schedule A, you know, would have been property taxes. We might have capitalized it due to AMT issues into the cost of the land. But that's where it goes. And nothing changed the issue of the deduction. It would still go on Schedule A. But here's the catch. While 164B6, which was added limitation, does limit the amount of deduction for taxes, for property taxes, income taxes, and sales taxes to $10,000, the problem is, if you read beyond that section, you know, if you go, so that's B6B tells us that. But there's a section at the very end of B6, after the A and B, that says the provision shall not apply to, in essence, any taxes described in paragraphs 1 and 2, income taxes and real estate taxes, which are paid or incurred in carrying on a trade or business. Well, we all knew that. That one we all caught early. Everybody heard about that. Or an activity described in Section 212. So our question becomes, we have this carve out. What is an activity described in 212? Well, if you go to Section 212 of the code, it tells us that basically there are three things that 212 covers, but the activity is really only two. And that is any activity for the production or collection of income, or for the management, conservation, or maintenance of property held for the production of income. And traditionally, we have taken our investment land as being land held eventually for the production of income. We finally sell it. You know, we expect it to give us income at the sale date. So here comes our bottom line. Is that tax exempt? Well, your first objection might be, well, wait a second. Okay, it's a 212 activity, but we all know that 212 activities, property held for investment, deductions related to those are not subject, you know, are basically our miscellaneous itemized deductions, and we can't get those anymore. So, you know, yeah, you may get an exemption here, but they'll take it away somewhere else. The answer is actually no. See, Section 67G does disallow us from claiming any miscellaneous itemized deductions, but Section 67B2 specifically excludes from the definition of miscellaneous itemized deductions any taxes for which a deduction is allowed under 164, which is what we have here. So 212 is referenced only to figure out if the activity would be covered by 212, but once we figure that out, the deduction still goes back to 164. So that means that, you know, that line for taxes not subject to the limit on Schedule A, it seems like this should be on that line. Now, the IRS doesn't give a whole lot of instructions about that line, doesn't tell us a whole lot about that line, but it appears the black letter of the law is pretty clear. Could the IRS attack? There's a couple of possibilities, maybe. Maybe the IRS says the key word there is activity. And 212 itself doesn't describe activities. So they're saying clearly what Congress meant was you need to be doing something, and holding raw land isn't doing anything. But the problem with that is really, does that make sense? I mean, what is the 212 activity that we're talking about here? And okay, a rental that doesn't rise to a trade or business. Aha, we found one. Well, yeah, but Congress could have very easily carved out rentals and royalties if that was their key, the only 212s that could get a benefit, the same way they did under Section 62, where they moved those above the line. It seems like, I think it's a stretch to say that holding the raw land's not an activity. It seems to me the general context of that. I mean, we test for trade or business by how much activity we have, and if we don't have enough activity, then it's not a trade or business, and it's a 212 item. Well, it still could be a 212 activity, we just don't have enough regular and continuous activity to get us up to the trade or business line. So, fundamentally, it seems very likely that there's at least a reasonable basis, if not actually, substantial authority, for taking that deduction on Schedule A. Now, you can compare this to an issue we wrote up early in the year regarding real estate cooperatives. By the way, when you say cooperatives, we have to watch. Depending upon which person you're talking to, they'll make an assumption that's totally different. I'm talking about real estate cooperatives. These are corporations that own the residential property you own shares in. It gives you a right to live in that unit, or at least to use that unit. You could rent it out or whatever you can do under this. It's kind of a other way to arrange what otherwise would be a condominium structure. Condominiums have common areas that are owned by everybody, and then the individual owner of the unit owns the unit. In the case of a cooperative, the corporation owns everything, but you have an absolute right to use one unit. Different way of doing the same thing. But there's a structural flaw that we discussed back at the beginning of this year in how Congress references the deduction for taxes on cooperatives that appears to bypass the $164 $10,000 limitation. But that one was clearly a mistake. Congress is very clear. Now, the Blue Book tells us a technical correction may be needed. Whenever the Blue Book says that, it means a technical correction is definitely needed. But, it's one of those things. While in this case, I don't think this is a mistake. I think Congress intended to let the raw land deduction go through. And if that's true, then I think some people may have discovered there are some returns that you might want to consider amending. If you've taken the position and used the cap on what was raw land or any other property that might meet the 212 definition. So, take a look. It's kind of interesting, but if it meets 212, it doesn't appear the $10,000 cap would apply, even though you're still deducting it on Schedule A. This doesn't move it off Schedule A. This just moves it out of the cap. Next up, the IRS is issuing draft forms, and in this case, the draft of the Form 1065, the 1120S, and the K-1s related to the same came out on September the 26th. Now, we'd already had a preliminary view of the S-Corp K-1 we discussed earlier, but now we're going to go ahead and look at some more details about all parts of all these forms. So these drafts came out on September the 26th, and the draft versions, if you go to the IRS website right now, at least until they cease to be the drafts and we get some finals, they'll show September 26, 2019 as the version that you're working with. So what exactly is changing? There are a few changes. One big one you're going to find, and this relates to something that has gotten a lot more attention on the website. I get statistics on what people read the most, and this has been the key thing read for a long time. We now have a requirement that you have to give your capital, tax basis capital, if it was negative. The instructions for 1065 last year said if a partner has negative tax basis capital and you're reporting capital on a K-1 on a basis other than tax basis, you have to include a disclosure of their tax basis beginning and ending capital. Well, next year, it's not going to be an option at all. In essence, whether it's positive or negative, you're going to disclose it because the only type of capital that can be shown on the K-1 next year is tax basis. We're getting rid of the 704B, the gap. Any other option for showing a partner's capital will not exist on the K-1. The capital on the K-1 has to be tax basis capital. So that'll be a significant change on next year's return if you've been using a non-tax basis capital. And I think a lot of people are panicking because they weren't sure how to get there. Well, gang, you're going to have to do it to prepare the return in the coming year. We know we already had to get that number. The negatives have to be sent into the IRS for 2018 returns by March 15th of next year, or you never properly filed your K-1s. Now we're being told for the 19 returns, the only basis of capital you're going to show is tax basis. We also have some additional information on 704C disclosures for a partnership. We've had to disclose for a couple of years if there is a deferred, you know, kind of this built-in gain under 704C related to a partner for assets they contributed. And you had to attach a statement. Now what you're going to have to say is, in addition to that statement, every year you're going to have to give the beginning and ending share of unrecognized 704C gain or loss has to be disclosed on the K-1 for each partner. That's also brand new, obviously something they're of interest on. The K-1 for the 1065 also has now divided guaranteed payments into guaranteed payments for services and guaranteed payments for capital. And then there is like a total guaranteed payment line as well that'll come in there. But we're dividing it into two parts. We've always had two types of guaranteed payments, but traditionally they'd always been on the same line on the K-1. Now they're going to be on two separate lines. For both the S-Corp and partnership K-1, the S-Corp and partnership return, the IRS is going to ask you for information about activities. If you have more than one activity for which under the at-risk rules or the disclosure or the passive activity rules, you have to tell them first if you're combining any of those. That's a checkbox on the front of the tax return. But secondly, if you have multiple activities or multiple activities for either at-risk or passive, there's going to be additional information that will be attached to the K-1 for the partners. Now, we don't know what that information will be right now because we don't have the instructions, but you can get a pretty good guess as to what it's going to be regarding that level. And finally, what we had discovered earlier in the year when the 1099, when the 1120S first draft came out, we're going to have 199 Cap A disclosures will no longer be the four codes we had for 18 returns. We're now going to have just basically a single line that says, you know, see attached for information you need to do the 199 Cap A calculation related on this partnership or this S-Corp. And then we're supposed to provide all necessary information. As I noted back when that first came out, I think the IRS has quickly discovered that there's a lot of information you need to know about to adjust your qualified business income from a pass-through on the individual return. And for that reason, they have given up on having codes for everything. You're simply going to give a line item description. You're going to come, you know, kick out and say, these are all the items you need to know. You'll need to know what QBI is. You'll need to know what UBIA is. You'll need to know what W-2 wages are. You need to know if it's a specified service trade or business or not. Those are things we already had to tell. But you also need to know about things like 179 related to each trader business. You need to know about potentially other issues that may be tested at the partner level. So all that stuff, in essence, it's now going to be textual. Why did they make these changes? Most likely because these are things they're interested on doing exams on in the future. Remember, we have just started the new comprehensive partnership audit regime. So we're going to see CPAR audits on 18 returns and later, CPAR or BBA, whichever way you want to refer to them. I've joked with, I started calling them BBA when they first came out. Then the IRS kept referring to them as CPAR. So I changed all my manuals to CPAR. Now the first year we actually do it, they're referring to it as BBA again. So the Bipartisan Budget Act rule. So these are probably things the IRS will be interested in, so you probably want to keep your eyes on these issues and start getting ready to get that information you're going to need, especially for tax basis capital, because they're serious about that now in the partnership. The final thing released this week, we have proposed regulations that are going to deal with individual coverage HRAs. These are proposed regulations under Reg 136-401-18, was issued on September 30th. And the point of these regs is to give us some information for this individual coverage HRA about how it interacts for applicable large employers that have shared responsibility issues, right? Shared responsibility payment issues. The IRS, when they released this, of course, it said, hey, ALEs can use this. But that opened up a lot of questions. If you're subject to the penalty for not providing affordable coverage to your employees, how do we determine what's affordable? What are our conditions here? Because remember, one of the issues here is we're using the employees going out and getting coverage on the individual market. How much of that do we need to pay for? How much of that counts? You know, what, you know, in essence, do I have to count every dollar the employee pays if they go by the highest, you know, absolute best Cadillac plan? Or is there some other plan I can count even if they go by the Cadillac plan? Those are all the issues we have to talk about. So what the IRS has done in this is they've created three safe harbors on specific issues. First, one key issue was, you know, how do we determine this cost of the applicable policy? So we're going to pick a policy, and what it will generally be is the, you know, lowest cost silver plan that applies for the appropriate geographic area. Now there's some open questions there, but we'll get there in just a second. But the question is it going to be different every month? I mean, when do we do this? So they established a safe harbor that first thing is gives us a month. If an employee is eligible to be in the HRA as of the first day of the year, then we can use the monthly premium for January of the prior calendar year, if it works that way for calendar year individual coverage HRA. And if it's on a plan year other than calendar year, then use the monthly premium for the lowest cost silver plan for January of the current calendar year. If an employee comes in during the year, then what you're going to do is modify that slightly. There'll be a slightly modified version for that point. They also make some minor changes to the affordability safe harbors that we have there under the standard regs. You want to go check those out. For the most part, they just update the references so it can use the individual coverage HRA regulations. Not much there. The three tests we had before for W-2 wages, W-2 wage test, the rate of pay safe harbor, or the federal poverty rate safe harbor are basically still there. Just they now can use the individual coverage HRA numbers in computing those things. And finally, we're looking for a location safe harbor because, again, it could be that there are different rates. Let's say that you live on, you know, your employee lives in one coverage area but works in another. Which rates do we use? And the answer becomes generally, you're going to be able to use the rate for where the place of employment is, regardless of where the employee actually lives. So if your normal place of employment is, let's say, in Phoenix, you're going to use the rates here in Phoenix. If the employee's normal place of employment was, let's say, in New York City, you'd use New York City, even though the employee may live in New Jersey. You know, that's just how we're going to do it. It's going to be for that area. Now, there are special rules that apply if a couple things happen. If the location where the employee performs services changes, then we have to update, right? If the location for changes for services changes and we expect it to be permanent, we have to update that no later than the first day of the second calendar month after the employee begins performing services at the new location. We also have special rules if the employees are remote workers and if they have a regularly assigned place, even though they're allowed to work from home. So let's say you have a desk for them at your accounting firm office, but they work from home like most days of the week, but they come into the office at their desk to meet with clients or do some other issues. Well, if there is a place, a permanent place they're assigned to be at, they could be at, then that's still going to be the place we're going to use for coverage. If they have no such permanent location that they're assigned to, then we're going to go ahead and we're going to use where they live. We have other rules for where they determine their age. You know, the age we're going to use because of this, and how do the applicable lowest cost silver plan. So we have issues there for that in the regulations, how we compute the required contribution based on that lowest silver cost plan. And there are revisions made to the anti-discrimination rules for HRAs or, you know, under Section 105, we have to be anti-discrimination. One key issue If you're going to establish one of these plans, and they can first be established for 2020, these regulations probably won't be finalized by the beginning of 2020, but the rules do apply that we can rely on these regulations up until the first year beginning more than 6 months after they go final. So these regs allow you to effectively design a plan today to implement next year, and you know you're going to get at least 6 months lead time if you have to modify plans for any changes in the final regulations. Well, as always, be sure you register now for your fall CPE. We got a bunch of things coming up, and you want to check with your state society, find out what's going. I want to say specifically, I'm going to have 2 days coming up here, right at the very end of the month and beginning of next month. October 31st, I'm going to have a course on partnership and S-corporation basis distribution issues in Boise. And I'll also have on November 1st, Section 199 Cap A Explored, Planning for Qualified Business Income. Both of those will be in Boise, Idaho, at the Idaho Society of CPAs offices and webcast by Idaho. So if you want to sign up for that, that'll be at idcpa.org. The key issue is the early registration date ends on October 10th. So yeah, you need to get signed up now if you want to get the savings often, and CPAs love savings. So you might want to take a look there. Again, the partnership and S-Corp courses, these new form changes are going to be kind of a discussion because obviously basis is a key issue for the whole tax basis partnership capital. And then we'll also talk about the issues and all the wonderful informal guidance we've gotten all year on 199 Cap A, plus just kind of catch our breath and finally have a year to plan with 199 Cap A where we actually know what the rules are. And we'll talk about that in the course. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 7th, 2019. You can catch our updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Ed Zollers. You can also email me, my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I also follow the discussions on Reddit at the reddit.com/r/taxpros group. And follow discussions on some state CPA societies, California's Tax Talk group, which is available to any CPA or any attorney anywhere in the country. You can go to groups.yahoo.com, search for Tax Talk as a group, ask to get in, show you're a CPA or attorney, you'll get in. I also follow discussions on three state societies, the Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey Society Connect group. So if you're a member of one of those societies, I do try to look in there and see if there's any question I can be of help on. So if you want to have a discussion there, go ahead and post there. Otherwise, hopefully you're having a successful end of tax season. I know it's that wild last week that you're working on, and you know you're going to get into the middle of that, and hopefully we'll see how next week goes, because I also have things to finish up. So if we get out exactly on time next week, it'll be kind of interesting, but we'll hope. So in any event, I'll be watching, and there'll definitely be some things happening. So we'll try to let you know what's up and going, and you'll join us next week for more current federal tax developments.